Session number 16714, Richard Forbes, Reel 5.
Mr. Forbes, Reel 5. You're down in the Cotswolds, Mr. Forbes, and you're talking about your own personal billets in the farm. Was it difficult having so many girls and young ladies around men who were living with men?
Well, of course, at first, of course, both sides sort of stood off from each other and, didn't know what they were in for. But gradually they came to realise that we weren't as rough and as rude as they'd made us out to be. And we recognised that they had some very sterling qualities. And we got to know them extremely well indeed. In fact, we used to spend more of our time in their farmhouse kitchen than we did in our own particular sitting room. We used to play card games with them and fool on and all the rest of it. And there was always dancers at Cheltenham Town Hall. So we used to select our partner and go off to the town hall and have a good time there. And on the whole, we got on extremely well, not only with this particular family, but with other families who invited us out to a meal and so on. But of course, we had so very little time, and also our bodies were being flogged so hard that usually all we wanted to do was to go upstairs to bed, because Brigadier General Churchill, he wouldn't let up for a second at all. He really drove us hard. Of course, we didn't realise the importance of that aspect of training, of driving a man to the limit, otherwise he's no good in wartime. But we thought it was just a big bore, you see.
Yes, you see, he was quite a martinet.
Oh, yes, he was. But a martinet with the right ideas and the right objective, not for the point of view of just being horrible for the sake of being it, but for getting us up to the standard which he knew would apply when the actual war conditions were met us face to face. And, of course, looking back now, it was the right sort of training.
And he was 151 Brigade Commander, wasn't he?
That's right, he was, 151 Brigade.
Your divisional commander, who was that?
Oh, wasn't that Martel?
Did you get much chance to meet him? Or
no, I never met him. No, I can't fill you in on that. Harry Sowood would know, but no, I can't remember that. I can't think of that one.
How did the rest of the battalion settle in into the area that you were now in?
Well, they had similar experiences to us. There were three companies all spread around in the same sort of area, and they were regarded as interlopers and outstragers and peculiar people. But like us, once they got to know what we're really like underneath, they were very, very keen to help us, the most hospitable, let us into their own homes, did things for us, like mending clothes and all the rest of it, which we couldn't do. And by the time we left, of course, they were very, very sorry to leave us go. And even after we had left, we still used to get correspondence from them when we were in France. And, of course, later on, me as a POW, they used to write letters to us from the farmhouse where we billeted. So we created a very good impression, and we had a very, very good time. But I say it was really hard training from, early in the morning to late at night, and just all you want to do is to go to bed and go to sleep.
What form was the training taking?
Well, it gradually worked up from section training to company, and then battalion, and then we'd have battalions working together. And up to the time, just before we went overseas, we worked up to divisional training, where you had whole battalions with all arms, with all their arms that we had available for normal warfare. Doing large exercises over large stretches of country. So we had worked ourselves up to a sort of divisional fighting fitness level before we went overseas, you see, unlike some of the second battalions which followed on, which weren't ready, you see, at all.
Had you received the motorised transport that you should have had as a motorised division?
No, we'd received some. It wasn't until we got across to France that we began to get it all. But so far as the infantry battalion was concerned, we got everything we wanted before we actually left. But there were so many lorries, of course, to bring along, that it wasn't physically possible to get them jammed into this country. But once we got across to France, of course, we were okay.
Did you requisition any vehicles for your training?
And oh, oh we, Do you mean when the war after the war started?
Down in the Cotswold area.
Yes, I think we requisitioned some civilian lorries. I think yes, we did, but of course they weren't very satisfactory because they're always breaking down because they're old, you know, clapped out old things. But as I said, just shortly before we went overseas, we suddenly got everything in one go, which again was a learning process which we hadn't gone through, of learning how to handle large numbers of vehicles and weapons and all the rest of it. But being a good battalion, a good division, that didn't get us down. Let's get
did
at
you
it.
Receive any visits from high-ranking people whilst you were down there?
No, I couldn't remember.
Did the King come, for example?
No, he came, this is another part, he came in 1939 to Gateshead to inspect the battalion. Didn't I put that in my little notes to you sometime?
He did come to the Cotswolds as well in the January.
He did, that's right. But he came to see our battalion, and presumably the other's battalion, in 1939, just before the war started, to inspect the whole of the Territorial Army battalions in the 5th Division to sort of boost up the morale and all the rest of it. And we did for him, which was only done for royalty or very, very important people, we fired him a feu de joie. Did I have described that to you? Well, a feu de joie is very interesting. You line up in front of the VIP in great long ranks. Each man is issued with a blank cartridge before he starts. He then, on the command, he raises his rifle, places it on his right shoulder with the butt firing to the sky. Left-hand man fires one shot. The next man to him fires another shot, and it goes rapidly right down the front rank, goes to the end of the first rank, starts at the beginning of the second, and right down again, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And that's only done for royalty or VIPs, and that's called a feu de joie, which is, of course, is a French expression that, you know, you're firing for joy. It's welcome. And that was done on Prince Consort Row Rugby Ground in 1939. So that's that one.
And you can't recall him coming actually to you being paraded in Chipping Norton?
Oh yes, Chipping Norton. Now, I don't know what time the parade was. Well, say the parade was 10 o'clock for the King, right? And of course it was the coldest winter we've ever had for years and years. Snow pelting down. So of course, typical army, it starts off at the general level. So if it's 10 o'clock for the King, right, it's 9:30 for the division, you see. 9:30, right, we'll make that 9 o'clock for the brigade. Right, so by the time it got down to the poor infantry battalion, I think it was around about 8 o'clock we had to be on parade. And we're standing there, 8th Battalion, 6th will confirm this, in Chipping Norton Square, with the snow belting down, bitterly cold, just waiting there for the King to appear. And this because was the way the army works. Everybody puts a little bit on. And by the time we come down to poor old Joe Snooks at the end of it all, it's perhaps 2 hours earlier. And that's how you prepared for the King. But it was very impressive because whilst he was such a quiet and self-effacing man, it had a big impression upon you because he was doing that to try and boost your morale. And yet it was coming from a man who, in a sense, needed the morale boosting. So, you know, it sort of was a double-edged sword and it affected you in that particular way.
Did you get the chance to meet him?
Of course, I did later on when I was awarded the Military Cross. I met him at Buckingham Palace. And he'd been bribed, of course, by one of his equerries and said, now, how did you manage to survive being a POW, Forbes? I said, not too bad, I'm still here and I'm still warm. And that's all he had to say to me, because you weren't allowed more than a brief word, you see.
Did you shake his hand, for example?
Of course, you get strict instructions of what to do before you start, you see. You go up, you bow, he'll say a few words to you, he'll shake you by the hand. As soon as he shakes you by the hand, you get off out of the way, the next man on, you see. It's really like a military operation.
The long the stand that you had in Chipping Norton, you managed that all right? There were no men dropping out of it all with the cold?
No, you see, they were weeded out really at the beginning because we all had to go through a medical examination, and some of the really veteran TA, other ranks and officers for that matter, were weeded out before we got down to Chipping Norton. So of course they had to be fit, you see, to stand the rigours of the training, and this is what happened. And of course after Dunkirk, of course the CO and one or two other officers and a lot of other ranks, they were removed too because they'd been found not fit enough, you see, for the rigours of warfare. So they had to go on to these, I think they were called training battalions or something they called them.
Did you lose any men in these early stages, key men that were sent back into the mines or industry?
No, we managed to hang on to them as far as I remember. It wasn't until later on that they realised that miners were probably more use in the mines rather than in the Tayor. But you see, the Durrans were so strong in miners, if you like to put it that way, that, you know, the very thought of taking key men out into the mines was just not, it just wasn't on. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't know of anybody that was taken out.
So you're doing your normal training, or training for becoming better soldiers, in effect, prior to going to France.
Mm-hmm.
The playing side, were you able to play games?
Yes. There was constant football matches, running, and then, of course, indoor games. We'd play, platoon against platoon, companies against companies, darts and all the rest of it. But the great game in our company headquarters was a mixture of football and rugby. We'd make two piles of clothes for goalposts, and all you had to do was to get the ball with or without the body through between those two goalposts. So if you got bored with kicking the ball, you'd pick it up with running. If you got bored with running, you just hacked at it. And of course, Bill Robinson, being so absolutely strong and vigorous and huge, he just used to brush everybody up and run through. But they were the sort of games we'd play, or we'd have the officers against the NCOs, or 13 platoon against 10 platoon, that sort of thing. So there was a lot of competitive sports going on because, again, it's part of the general training of not only sportsmanship, but working together. So that's what we used to do.
Did you get involved with games with the civilians?
No, we didn't very much. Not that I can think of. In the, you see, we had so little time off to sort of socialise. It all comes back to lack of time and a driving brigadier general. But that side was important, and we did socialise, of course, in going out with them into pubs and going to dances and so on. But not specifically, say, platoon number 10 platoon will play the Joe Snooks team from, say, Chipping Norton or something like that. There was very little of that, as far as I know, in my battalion, unless the 6th and 8th did.
Where was your platoon billeted?
My platoon was billeted in there were houses round about this main. We were in what was originally the manor house, and the headquarter company was billeted round. There were some cottages and houses round about that area, and they were billeted in there. So we were quite a tight little community of our own in headquarter battalion, because they had the signalling platoon, the intelligence platoon, the transport platoon, and the carrier platoon, all an HQ company. So of course they were all billeted in that particular area, and the other outlying companies were billeted in different villages. I always remember Chipping Camden and another Camden.
But the men there would be basically in barns or warehouses.
Oh yeah, yes, barns. Yes, it was pretty rough and ready, and we were fortunate to have a roof over our heads and a bed to lie in. But that was wartime. We had no time for niceties, and there were no grumbles. Well, there might have been a few grumbles, but we got on with it.
Cooking your own food, as you had been doing, and your own cooks.
Oh, we had our own cooks. Of course, they became full time cooks. They had to organise all the cooking, and I was given one of the additional jobs. I was made catering officer and had to order all the food for the whole of the company. And of course, I knew nothing at all about it. So of course, that's the army all over. There's the list. That's how much you can order per head, per man, per day. Get on with it, Forbes. Very good. So in the middle of training the carrier platoon. So I used to confer with my sergeant major and say, now, how many eggs shall we go to buy today? How many sides of bacon? How many half weights of sugar? Because we all had to order in bulk, you see. Some you had to buy from civilian suppliers. Others, of course, was army rations, which came from army officers. But it was all based on so much per head per man. And, of course, the worst part of the job was not doing ordering the food, was doing the blooming books at night to work out to balance the books. But it was all good experience, but I knew nothing at all about catering. But that's the army all over.
Presumably, each cookhouse would tell you what they'd use.
Oh yes, it's all under control through the quartermaster sergeant, you see, of each company. He would know what he was entitled to, get it from headquarters, dish it out, and then if there's anything left over, like if he issued 20 tins, They've only used 10. He want 10 tins back or sign it off the books. Oh, it was all pretty well tightly controlled, but of course, you know, cooks. Things would tend to slip through, or the best bits would go to them, but that's one of the perks of the job. But they still had to do some training as well, and they had to learn how to shoot. But without cooks, the army's not much good.
Did you set up your own officers' mess?
Oh, yes, we had our own officers' mess, little separate room, and we tried to keep the mess system going. But, of course, being wartime, it was quite difficult in many ways. And, of course, on Christmas Day, because we weren't allowed Christmas leave, the officers, by tradition, had to serve the men, you see. And what I did, because all the men wanted to go home for Christmas, are we all right? I went round the local farmers, got some turkeys from them, and I went to see the local bakery in Chipping Mort in Morton and Marsh and said, look, would you cook these turkeys for us when you take the bread out? So on Christmas Day, all the troops had a marvellous turkey dinner cooked by the local baker. And you got an allowance of food, but you also got an allowance of money, you see, so you could buy little treats. So we got turkeys for them that Christmas and Christmas pudding. So they did quite well on the whole.
And officers and senior NCOs served them, didn't
they? No, the officers only. Everybody sat down, and the officers did all the dirty work, including serving, washing up, and all the rest of it, you see. Again, part of the idea, you know, of balancing that mutual respect, you see.
And you said you never had any leave to date.
We had one short leave. I think it was round about the end of October, November. I think it was about a week we had. But we didn't get Christmas leave because we're so near. We didn't know this, of course. We're so near to going overseas. So Christmas leave was all cancelled. Then the next thing we knew, of course, everything gathered together. Early January, off we went.
And this was your first opportunity to see your mother since she'd been whipped away.
Yes, yes.
How did she take you coming home from leaving your uniform?
Well, of course, it was very emotional for her, you see. And and also with the thought I had to tell her that I may not be here very long. Of course, you had to be careful what you said, you see. But so I had to leave her in not a very happy frame of mind. And then, of course, no Christmas leave. Then the next thing, of course, off we went. And then the next thing she would get from me, of course, would be a postcard saying, I am here. How are you? Goodbye. You know, a typical army postcard.
Had you started with instituting censorship?
Oh, yes, straight away. We had to read all the other ranks' mail, of course.
And you would need to read your
own
platoon.
Then one officer would be appointed by the company commander to censor all our mail. Oh, yes, it was mutual.
What exactly did it entail? Did you read it word for word, or how did you deal
with
it?
Well, we knew the man, first of all. Secondly, we couldn't read literally everything, but we got the main gist. We looked at for place names, troop movements, weapons, anything like that which he let slip. Otherwise, anything else, we just let it go through. Because it's so easy to give something away, you know, without thinking. But that's why one officer was appointed to vet our mail, you see, and then each officer met at his own platoon mail and sent it, you see.
It's been a very personal thing to read someone else's letters to their loved ones.
Oh, it is. Well, that's wartime, you see. And, of course, we used to have some very wry smiles. Dear dying wife, you see, so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. And then the same post. Dear Suzette, I'll see you tomorrow night. Don't forget to be there. From the same man, you see. But, of course, lips were sealed. But if that was going on, you'd keep an eye on him, you see. And you'd say, oh, have you heard from your wife lately? Have you had a letter, you see? That's sort of a tactful way of trying to, you know, mend fences. So there's more to being an officer than meets the eye.
Mail came coming to you all right?
In France, yes, yes, quite regularly. It was a very, very good service.
And have you any other memories of the Cotswolds?
Other memories of the Cotswolds? We were visited quite near to what they used to call the Four Shire Stone. That's where four counties met. Oxfordshire, Cambridge, Oxfordshire, Gloucestershire, Worcestershire, and one more, I forgot what it is now. So that was quite interesting. But otherwise, the main memory of the Cotswold is very, very hard work and training, gradually building up from platoon to divisional training, and then ready with complete arms and equipment, ready to go across and fight if need be straight away. And that's exactly what we did do.
Did you feel that you had reached a pitch that you were ready now?
Oh, yes. Well, you see, we all knew each other so intimately after being in the Terriers, you see, for several years. We knew exactly what each one could do, what those capabilities were. We knew all the NCOs, all the officers, and vice versa. So it wasn't a question of sort of learning about new people. And the only people that we suddenly had to absorb were those who were suddenly placed upon us from the artist rifles just before we went overseas.
So you got a draft from to complete your numbers, obviously, from the regiment. How did they settle?
Well, at first, of course, they were at sea. But once they got used to the way we go on, the sort of direct way we approach each other, they fitted in marvellously, and they became really excellent officers in every possible way. And in fact, quite often them used to write to me afterwards to say how much they'd enjoyed their time with us, because it is a big sort of cultural shock to come from the artist rifles up to the Durham Light Infantry. But there again, they fitted in very well indeed. And we regarded them as splendid adjuncts to the battalion.
When did you leave for France?
Oh, I can't remember the exact date. It was early January. It was the first fortnight in January, and bitterly cold weather. And, of course, it was a terrible crossing because the weather was so bad. And, of course, because of the blackout, everybody was battened down. You couldn't see a thing.
Before we get to that, were you seen off by the civilians? Did they know you were going?
No. Now, the way we departed was quite interesting. We were all told the night before we were going to move, right, we're going to move tomorrow, and what we're going to do is this. You must not say a word to anybody. This was just the day before we went. And round about 3 o'clock in the morning, we were all wakened up. We went downstairs, told our farmer friends, we're off now, and by 6 o'clock in the morning, we'd all disappear. This was all planned, and the village and the household and all the other people around about knew nothing at all about it. And when they woke up, normally, the whole division had disappeared. It was a marvellous piece of work, in a way, when you come to think of it. But I think it was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when we were waking up.
Did you go by train?
Now, I had to take the carriers to the station, load all the carriers onto these load trucks, and then we all went down by train. And I think all the others did too. We all got in the same. It went down by train, but those that had transport drove the transport down to Southampton Docks. But all the rest went by train. Yes, but we'd all gone in less than 12 hours, and all disappeared.
What were your feelings now that you know when you're going into an active situation?
Well, the feelings were that we're sorry to leave our friends behind. We knew what we'd signed up to do. There's no question or fear or doubt. Here we were, a job to be done, we're going to do it, full stop. And that was the general attitude. There's no question of, oh, I wish I hadn't signed up, or I wish I'd had to go home. No, the spirit of, which you get in a TA battalion, because they're so close together in peacetime, you see. When it comes to wartime, you're still there, you see. So there's nothing to relearn at all.
You sailed from Southampton, as you say, and it was, you were below decks, were you? And
oh, yes,
blacked
out,
and so
we're all blacked out.
What's your memories of the journey?
Well, the journey was such that it was so rough and bad, there was hardly any of us that weren't seasick. And this tension, noise, and smell down below was absolutely unbelievable. So when we eventually arrived at Cherbourg, and we started marching down the gangplank, you're talking about fighting the Germans who couldn't even blow a candle out. But after a few days, of course, we soon settled down. And of course, Durhams being Durhams, they soon found the way around. So when they went into a cafe and they wanted something to eat, hey, miss, I want a pot of tea, some awesome chips, and a can of beer if you have it. And they soon found out what awesome chips were, you see. Egg and chips, you see, and a pot of tea. But when we first arrived, we were so seasick and, you know, we just couldn't do anything.
What were your first impressions of France, arriving at the quay?
Well, not exactly hostile, but indifferent. You see, that they were in a most peculiar mood, the French. You see, they'd lost all their youth in the First World War. That become degenerate, less than no other word for it, degenerate, if you like, since the First World War. And who are these British soldiers coming to show us how to suck eggs, was the attitude. So we got no sort of welcome at all compared to the Cotswolds from the French. they're regarded as being necessary evil to be put up with. There's no question of cooperation or help at all.
Had you time in Cherbourg before you moved on?
No. It's just a sort of demarcation. Sort yourself out in the battalions. Then you moved off into your battalion sorting out area. And then very shortly you got together as a brigade in a particular area.
Where did you move to?
We went to Amiens first as a brigade. And then after several weeks hard training there, we moved up north into France, into the Lille, Pauvin, Couvin area, for obviously strategic reasons, to be near the Belgian border and near the Maginot Line was the idea.
Did the attitude of the French change as you moved into these First World War areas?
Some of them were reasonably well disposed towards us, but in general they were, as I say, they've become so sort of inward looking and degenerate in a way. And of course, when the fighting started, and particularly in Belgium, you'd find the British troops moving up to meet the Germans, and some of the French troops going backwards the other way to get out of it, often led by their officers. There were exceptions, mind you, but we are utterly disgusted with the way some of the French behaved. Not the way the British did at all.
You got your full transport by now?
Oh, yes. We moved entirely by transport.
Did this change your training once you were fully mobile?
No. We're still normal infantry, but we had to learn how to get into lorries quickly, sort ourselves out, drive to the appointed place, get out quickly, lorries move on, disperse, get in position and so on. And you had to do that in, out. This is what the training was about, you see. And we had a very interesting way of getting into lorries quickly. We had a great big heavy rope hanging from the roof of the back of the lorry. So each man jumped up, grabbed the rope, swung himself up, rope down, next man swung himself up. In a very short space of time, you get a lorry loaded, you see. Whereas if you just let them sort of bunch at the back of a lorry and climb in three or fours, you get them falling over each other. So they had to learn that sort of technique. But the most important thing was to get out of the lorry, jump out, into position, check the ground, and get themselves ready for whatever happens to come along.
Where would your carriers be in this scheme of things?
Well, usually right in the front. We had a probe to the front. In a way, it's rather like cavalry and scout cars. So we would probably be the outer screen to start off with, you see. And then when the fighting started, of course, we would be called upon, depending upon each circumstances, go here or do there or line that canal bank or go and help A company or letting it a bit stuck and so on. So we had to be mobile all the time.
So you went moved from the Amiens area to the Lille area.
Yes.
What were you doing there?
Well, funny enough, a lot of the time was spent by lots of the troops in digging trenches. The theory was, you see, that the Germans would sweep through Belgium and knock the defences down, and this would try and stop them in the north of France, you see, which is, of course, a complete waste of time. But that was one of the main engagements. And I'll tell you another... Yes, go on.
Did your men get involved in the digging, or were they...
Yes, everybody had a bit of a turn, but basically we kept to training as an infantry battalion, because there were Pioneer Corps, of course, as you know. They sort of did the major digging. But every now and again they were called upon to give a bit of a hand, but it was a futile exercise, but, you know, military thinking changes as the years go by. Yes, they thought that... In fact, we were just on the point of... The 51st Highland Division took their first turn in the Maginot Line, and just as they were going to come out and retake over, the Germans invaded, of course, and that was the end of that one. So we didn't get into the Maginot Line, thank goodness.
Did you stay in this area where you were digging the trench, or did you have another move before the German invasion?
Well, the battalion didn't, but I did personally, because they had what they call route regulation control, that is, officers mounted on bound, because I could ride a motorbike. I was picked out of my battalion to when the Germans invaded. The theory was, as soon as the Germans broke into the north of Belgium, the British troops would rush through Belgium and try and stop them, you see. So of course you can't do that in a strange country, not knowing where you're going. So there was my CO, Colonel, well, he's a major then, Slight, and myself on motorbikes. We were part of route regulation control. We'd studied the maps beforehand, so as soon as the balloon went up on the May the 10th, we had a belt up on our motorbikes and marked the route to Brussels for the British Army to follow, you see, irrespective of whatever the signs may say. So that was my particular job. In the meantime, again, on individual responsibility, I left my platoon in charge of the senior sergeant, you see, to carry on whilst I was doing motorbiking. That was one of the drawbacks of knowing how to ride a motorbike. I used to get all these dirty jobs to do.
You say marking the route. How did you mark the route?
We had lorries with us with signposts, and it was marked out British Army, whatever it happens to be, and you just followed the signposts. But because we were on motorbikes, we had to go along and do that for them, you see.